sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Yellen changes her tune and bonds fall. Earnings season fully underway. Less than a month until the presidential election. And our guest today, James Lundberg, co-founder and executive vice president of investment on Impact Investing. All this and much more on episode number 480 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, kids, how are you? Well, I call you kids, but we know that you're growing up. We know that you're all about investing and finance. That's what this show is all about. We're talking about all things around the world related to investing and finance. And one of the things that is obviously something that has become an important part of the world of investing and finance and corporate culture is the idea of impact investing. So we have a great show lined up today with our guest, James Lundberg. Before we get to that, introduce myself, Andrew Horowitz. If this is your first time listening, welcome aboard. I'm sure you'll be listening in for some time. You can also listen to the back archives and all the previous shows over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, on iTunes, or any of the other various different podcast networks that host podcasts. You'll find us. Just look it up on the web, type in my name, type in The Disciplined Investor, and you'll find it. But again, thanks for joining today. We have a good show today. A couple of things I wanted to talk about before we get to our guest today, and that relates to some of the news items that we saw last week, as well as markets. We saw that the markets were down last week. It was a rather, I would say, volatile week overall, with some confusion about the Fed, what they're doing, some of the earnings that are happening. Earnings season did spark off about a week and a half ago, and the industrials came in rather weak in terms of their guidance, and we saw the banks hit hard at the end of the week this week. And the problem with the banks is you really don't know if they beat, if they missed, if the analysts are just way off, if there's something embedded in the various income and financial statements that is causing them to either beat or miss on the earnings. We saw that, of course, JP Morgan blew out earnings on both revenue and on the net. So top and bottom line on both sides. And the stock ended up kind of nowhere. Wells Fargo came in, beat a bit, but then there was still some discussion about some new allegations against them with regard to overdraft protection. Seems that even though John Stumpf, the CEO and chairman of Wells Fargo, stepped down last week, there's still a lot of questions that remain unanswered in terms of that stock, that company, and what's going on there. But I think some of the things surrounding the banks are continuing to be the yield curve that's a concern, lack of earnings power, low volatility and volume in markets, just a lot of things that are coalescing and coming together to create problems. Not to mention the fact that oil, while it is up a bit right now, is still low and they have a lot of bonds they issued and loans to many of the oil producers. And then you also look at what's going on in Europe, which is not necessarily good for the banks here. So, you know, overall, there's been I would say the start of the earnings season has been, it's been gloomy. There was the hope that this quarter was the quarter that things would just perk up, everything would turn around, and there would be a kind of a new leg to the upturn in growth, or there would be after five quarters of slowing growth, and actually negative growth of EPS and revenues tailing off, that there would be something good. You know, the other thing that really affected markets has been the fact that the dollar, and bonds, by the way, but the dollar has been climbing. We hit 98 on the Dixie on Friday. And this is after a speech by Federal Reserve Chairman Yellen, on Friday afternoon when she kind of changed her tune a little bit. She was talking about for the longest time, you know, the extended period of having stimulus and, you know, really being very dovish and going against the thought that, well, you know, we hit our inflation targets and we hit our employment targets and, well, we've got to start normalizing. And they've been postponing and holding off. But it seems that there's been a bit of a more hawkish tone. And more importantly, what it seemed like to me, at least, was her speech on Friday talked about how monetary stimulus probably cannot provide the growth engine for the economy. And she used some interesting words. She talked about running a high performance economy. And the Fed does this from time to time. They come up with some, you know, remember way back when Bernanke was talking about his green shoots? And we all had to talk about the green shoots forever and exactly what that meant and how that really played out. Now they're talking about running a high-performance economy, which translates to allowing the economy to surpass the inflation targets that the Fed had before they really get into significant amount of drawing back on stimulus. And bonds, by the way, reacted very poorly to this. Because if we do have an inflationary environment and rates are naturally going to be kind of moving higher, because they will move higher as they have been recently, the 10-year hit 1.8% on Friday. And again, the dollar's been moving up with the idea that we are seeing some inflation. PPI came in a bit hot this week. CPI is coming out next week, this consumer price index, which is the inflation gauge. And we're seeing the unemployment rate at a low level, about 5%. We're seeing, I think, since 1973, the lowest level of initial claims on a weekly basis. So if, in fact, we do see that there is this allowance for us to have an inflation higher than the 2% benchmark that they have, and if, in fact, we see this as going to be part of the Fed's playbook, I think what they were trying to say was that, don't worry, we're not going to raise rates for some time, even if there is inflation, and that would hopefully cause the markets and everybody to be very cheerful. But the opposite happened. In fact, what happened was that bonds had probably the worst week, probably in 2016. I talked about this last week. I talked about this the week before. I talked about this several weeks ago when I said, you know what? If you want to take a look at your bond portfolios, now's the time. This is probably about a month and a half ago. I said, you know, we really need to start looking at this, because with what's going on in the UK with Brexit and the fact that the pound has dropped down dramatically, we saw that mini flash crash last week, and that's going to spark major inflation in that area with the inability for the Bank of England to really do much to contain it, because if they do, they'll slow down the economy. So they're kind of caught right now. And that will bleed out to the rest of the world. Now, are we going to have runaway inflation here? Well, probably not, for a lot of different reasons. Productivity still is not really that great. Wage increases and growth is not that great. A lot of things are going to probably stall because we have different buying patterns and shopping patterns these days. Retail sales came in right in line, up 0.6 last month, month over month. That was right in line on Friday. So again, nothing major happening on the inflation front. But when we see that there is still somewhat of a, I would say, a bit of a corrective environment when it comes to commodity prices and all of these oddball things happening with currencies around the world, I just don't see a runaway inflation situation happening that is going to be quick and surprising. We may have some, but again, it's going to be a slow process. But Yellen's change of her tune, I think, is probably going to be backed up this week coming up. Oh, you didn't understand what she was saying and the market got it wrong and all that, because they don't want bond yields really going up much higher, even though several of the Fed speakers this week also talked about how there's probably going to be a rate hike by the end of the year. So there's some balance probably going to come next week, especially ahead of the election, which is, what, less than a month away, or right at a month. They don't want a lot of confusion in markets. They don't want a lot of topsy-turvy and a lot of volatility ahead of that because who knows what the actual outcome is going to be. But anyway, we're going to talk more about that actually after we speak with our guest, James Lundberg. I'm going to talk about some of the handicapping of what sectors and what could do well in terms of market sectors and markets and tax issues. As we know it right now, dependent on either a Clinton presidency or a Trump presidency. Now, however you see it, forget about it politically. You know, I'm not talking about that because we really don't know the end result. Yes, it looks like Hillary Clinton has a greater odds of winning the election as of right now. But there's a lot of time between now and the election. A lot of things are going on that either, you know, one can either win or one could lose it for themselves by the time the election comes around. So we'll talk about that, and we'll get into some discussion about some of the winners and losers and the potential ways to look at this market and some earnings season issues as well, right after we talk with our guests. One more thing I'll mention to you, if you want to ask me a question, you want to have it on the air on the next episode or so, send me a note over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Top right, there's an Ask Andrew button. Click that, send it right to me. So let's move along, and as I had mentioned, our guest today is James Lundberg, and he is co-founder and executive vice president of InvestNet. And we're glad to have him today because we're going to talk about something that I don't think in all the years that we have been doing this, which is going on, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, 9 years. We're talking about socially responsible investing, which I think these days, Jim, has a new name. It's called impact investing. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the common phrase now is impact investing. It's a term that the Rockefeller Foundation had coined about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's now the latest sort of most common vernacular for what can be called SRI, socially responsible investing, or ESG, or sustainable investing. Many of us now call it impact investing. And as we think about impact investing, I think the most common definition is something around impact investments are investments made into companies, organizations, and funds with the intention to generate a social and an environmental impact alongside a financial return.
And obviously we mean a positive social and environmental impact, right? I mean, obviously that's the whole point. I mean, so when we look at the opposite side of things, I always like to let's separate this for a second and kind of give some examples of what may or may not be maybe in the genre of impact investing. So like, for example, a company like Philip Morris, that wouldn't necessarily fall within that parameter, right?
That's correct. So a positive impact investment, for example, in the environment, may be to identify emerging green technologies that will address issues of global warming and its effects, and invest and promote green energy technologies that offer a financial return, a competitive financial return, but also do something positive for the environment. So we can think about those types of investments across environmental factors, social factors, as well as corporate governance factors.
So like just kind of fishing around here, a company like, for example, Berkshire Hathaway, where Warren Buffett is inclined to give a lot of money to charities or most of his wealth to charities, but some of the underlying companies that he has may or may not be in line. This may be a weird example. Or Microsoft, where Bill Gates is giving away all sorts of money to charities. Does that fall within the social impact investing?
Maybe or maybe not. Let's take Microsoft, for example. So the fact that money is being given away by corporate leaders in and of itself wouldn't qualify a company for being an impact investment. However, if you look at Microsoft and those that would be concerned about governance or social issues, particularly around gender equality and opportunities corporately, If you look at the C-suite, if you look at the board of directors of Microsoft, it's a diversified group of people across gender and all types of perspectives. So that might be one quality that would elevate Microsoft to being an impact type of investment by virtue of gender equality and opportunity among management.
So, but let's look at another example of a company, for example, like a Tesla. So Tesla has, and Elon Musk for that matter, and let's put aside his desire to go to Mars and have, in a number of years, some kind of a civilization up there. Let's put that aside for a moment, okay? And look at all the other things that he does. So Elon Musk and Tesla, so they have, I would assume Tesla, by the nature of its electrical, non-emission type of, cars, and maybe even Solar City, which is all about obviously harvesting the energy from the sun and getting away from fossil fuels, et cetera, that would probably be a company in line with a strong rating, if you would, for an impact investing. That would hit the mark, right?
Yes, that would be a great example.
So what, some of the research that you've done is that the whole idea of, when we started way back when with the whole idea of, I think there was a mutual fund or something, the socially responsible, XYZ fund. It was kind of an idea and something that was interesting in a thematic type of situation. But you did some research and you've referenced it on actually the performance of the more socially responsible impact style investing companies versus just the core S&P, right? Or just the core investments.
S&P 500. So we've done some studies, and there's been other studies that have been completed around this notion of sustainable investments over a long period of time, over a market cycle, just by nature of a company being socially aware and having proactive governance and other types of policies. Will they over time outperform just a broad market index? And what we've seen in some broad studies, MSCI did a study going back to January of 1993, comparing the KLD 400 index, which is an index of four of the largest 400 ESG or socially responsible companies that score the highest. There's been a consistent outperformance over all types of market cycles of ESG companies relative to a broad market index. The study that we've done is to look at impact or ESG mutual funds versus traditional mutual funds. And what we did is we went back 7 years and looked at a full market cycle. And what we found is that the impact or the ESG-oriented funds outperformed traditional mutual funds 64% of the time.
Hmm. Wow, that's pretty impressive. But what came first? I mean, let's go back, 50 years. Let's just take that time period and say, well, back then, if we would have had this discussion and we would have talked about maybe, let's say 25 years, that, technology-oriented companies, forgetting about impact and all that, in terms of environmental for a moment, but, technology-oriented companies, that is going to be the best thing because that's what everybody's focusing on. That's the new revolution in investing. Is impact investing just a, do you think it could be just a theme that has a certain lifespan? Because now we are so aware of all the various things that, we're doing to hurt the earth and to in terms of our own health and, things of that nature, or is it a much bigger situation? Is it much bigger than that?
Yeah, I think it is bigger than that. I think it's, a trend and an approach to investing that will remain. So if we go back historically, really investing with a mission orientation, aligning social passions with portfolios, really was led by large institutions, foundations, family offices that had the wherewithal to really do the underlying research and to seek out companies that were aligned with their mission. The American Cancer Foundation, for example, certainly didn't want to be investing in Philip Morris, back to your earlier point. So the real beginning of this was around institutions and largely approaching social investing with a clean hands perspective, meaning that they didn't want to invest in objectionable securities. Increasingly, what I think has led to the opportunity for individual investors has been a couple of things. One is that there is the emergence of the underlying research companies, organizations like Sustainalytics or MSCI, or more recently, Morningstar, that will look at underlying securities and provide rankings and research based on a social criterion of individual securities. You know, we've always been able to get access to, well, what is a company's gross margin or the rate of increase in revenues or any other financial measure. But just more recently, there's companies out there that can help us understand environmental footprint or governance policies or human rights or equality policies. And then we can use those types of criterion as part of the screening process. We've also seen an emergence of specialty investments, packaged investments, whether it be mutual funds, even indexes now, separately managed accounts, so that individual investors can identify social passions and then match that up to actionable investment opportunities with a rating on them, where they can invest in a way that's aligned with their passions and mandates.
You know, it's interesting because a number of years ago, before this case, you know, it was always becoming more and more popular, this concept. But I did notice on the Bloomberg terminal, the private and pay for, if you will, not the Bloomberg site, but the Bloomberg terminal always had, I believe it was called the sustainability index rating for companies. And you could break it down from there and see what that was comprised of and where the companies were. So they were pretty ahead of all this in terms of being able to, you know, come up with a level, an index, a rating of what the particular company's sustainability was, which obviously was good for use by whether it's mutual funds picking their stocks, doing a filter. Okay, only want a sustainability index of over X or Y, you know, et cetera. But one of the things I think is really interesting, and something is, I've always wondered, you know, you have someone like you mentioned, the American, you know, keep on picking on Philip Morris because I think the poster child for this, or maybe even Monsanto for that matter, right? But let's look at Philip Morris. So I'm an investor, and I'm like, you know what? Smoking's bad. You know, this whole, it causes cancer. It's I can't invest my money with Philip Morris. Let's just use that as my theme here for the moment. The thing, though, is that when I invest in Philip Morris, I'm investing in the secondary market. I'm not giving Philip Morris my money, right? But I'm investing in them as a stock because of other things aside from, let's say, the sustainability issues and the impact investing and their overall benefit to mankind. But maybe I'm investing because they have a good dividend. Maybe I'm investing because they do have a good return on equity and a lot of other metrics. However, because I am saying that I am not going to invest in a company that doesn't meet other criteria, so other social criteria, I won't invest there. But is Philip Morris really benefiting from my investment in their stock on the secondary market?
Well, yeah, because you're supporting a demand for their stock and supply and demand determine price. But it brings up an interesting point as you talk about returns and dividends. You know, up until there's been a body of knowledge here recently, I think the overwhelming consensus was is that if you didn't participate in stocks like Philip Morris and others that have traditionally had high rates or higher competitive rates of return, if you followed a socially responsible approach, that it was concessionary. That, in other words, if you didn't own these other types of stocks, that you'd have to give up return. And that's one of the compelling drivers of market adoption right now, is a realization that a socially responsible or socially aware portfolio is not necessarily concessionary. In fact, going back to some of the performance studies that I cited earlier, a strong argument is emerging academically and otherwise that a socially responsible approach to investing is actually beneficial. So it's been interesting to see the shift from let's do the right thing but prepared to take a concessionary return to really adopting social principles as a proactive tool in optimizing portfolios.
That's interesting. And then one of the other things is that we also have to look forward a little bit. And one of the things you wrote in an interesting paper was about, and I'll just read this, it says, the convergence that is bringing impact investing to the forefront may have and will have staying power. The consulting firm Accenture has estimated that $30 trillion will pass in the next half a century from baby boomers to younger investors, assuming they don't spend it all somehow. Many of whom have grown up with the opportunity of impact investing in a way not just true of older generations. For many such investors, investing for societal impact will be second nature. So, and there's been some studies about the millennials who have looked at this as something of more of an edict, I guess, rather than just an idea, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've done a lot of work on the transference of wealth over the coming years, nearly $3 trillion. And there's been a number of studies. Morgan Stanley has been instrumental in doing some research. And what they've done is they've looked at different segments of the investors that will receive this transfer of wealth. And what's discovered is, for example, among women investors, 75% responded that the social position, the environmental, social, and governance position of a company is important to their investment decision. It's even higher among millennials. 80% say that they will be mindful of a company's underlying ESG principles as they think about constructing portfolios. So a lot of the work that we do at InvestNet is working with advisors and helping advisors to be prepared for the next generations of investors. And broadly, there's a recognition in the market that for future investors, not only today, but increasingly for future, that the SRI or the ESG investing is really going to be an important part of the landscape in serving clients. We've also done a lot of interesting work around just how advisors can develop deeper relationships with their clients, and the opportunity to go beyond just, well, what are your financial goals or when do you want to retire, but to have a deeper level of conversation around, you know, what are your principles and what are you passionate about and what are your aspirations for the world? Let's align portfolios in a way that really speaks to something deeper in terms of your essence. And it's a terrific way to build deeper relationships and have portfolios that are matched up and aligned in a more critical way with investors' passions and their hopes.
So, you know, one of the things is, you know, we know that there are various activist investors in the world of hedge funds. For example, they'll go to a company and they'll say, hey, listen, the way that your current structure is, it's really not efficient financially. And, you know, they can go in and buy enough shares to make a difference in something to do with the company, right? Whether it's how they're spending money, who they're doing business with, how the company is structured, well, you know, name whatever it is that you want to look at. Is this the ultimate form of activist investing, whereas the the masses may, or at least a component of the masses, may take this to a level that forces companies to rethink their social impact and their footprint environmentally, et cetera, to make a change for the positive? Do you think that would be a kind of a, you know, part of this or a result of some of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, before when we were talking about Philip Morris again and owning a share of Philip Morris, well, by virtue of being a shareholder, there are opportunities to vote proxies and to shape corporate behavior and corporate governance. So it doesn't, it's not solely in the preview anymore of large hedge fund activists, but increasingly individual investors can vote proxies and have influence on corporations and their governance and their strategy. And that's another lever fueling the growth in sustainable or social responsible investing.
Hmm. Now, I wonder, I mean, you know, these various companies, I've always been curious, where does Starbucks lie in all of this? You know, we have coffee, which has caffeine in it, which is a, you know, it's a drug of sorts, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously not, well, it's natural, but it's a drug. You know, they have the whole coffee. They're obviously doing a lot in the area of farming and owning farms and owning coffee beaneries, you know, all the different places and all that. But yet they have a lot of good things they do on the other side. Starbucks considered a socially responsible company?
In many aspects, it is. You've pointed to some of them in terms of fair trade, in terms of how they source and bring to market the coffee and the goods. But also, just in terms of employees and the way that they treat their employees. Mm-hmm. One of the things that catches a lot of attention is Starbucks' corporate position on providing healthcare services to their employees. So it can be multifaceted, but many socially responsible investors will look at a number of the things that Starbucks is doing and see them as a sustainable company that's doing good, for their providers worldwide, but also for their employees domestically, mm-hmm. and their employees worldwide, for that matter.
Right. I mean, I'm sure we could pick apart any company out there or any there are clearly certain sectors. Let's look at the companies that are all in on fossil fuels. And many of them have, by the way, you know, separated and tried to do more clean energy, et cetera, for two reasons. First, obviously, that's a trend that they need to keep ahead of, and they need to make sure that if it does end up, if snap your fingers and all of a sudden everybody and every vehicle is all electric or otherwise, some other power, not fossil fuels, these companies would have a problem. So they're obviously, many companies are swayed by the dollar, the end of day profits, and they have to make changes along the way. What companies, what sectors, what areas of the markets are those that are kind of like, I don't know if they could ever get to a point of being on this list?
Well, I think that what investors are looking for, I mean, there's a realism around fossil fuels, and that is the primary sort of source of energy today. But they're looking for companies that are investing in green technologies going forward, and really promoting green energy, more efficient energy that's better for the environment. So there is a level of realism, but an expectation that through investments, you can make an impact to promote and to support companies that are moving things more to a sustainable stance.
Right.
It's many realistic, sustainable investors. They're going to want to have broad market exposure, and they'll recognize that energy is an important part of a well-diversified portfolio. So it's not a matter of just saying we're not going to invest in energy as an asset class or segment. but rather look at those companies that are making strides forward and overweight their exposure and energy to the companies that are representing sustainability and innovation towards a less impactful environmental sort of impact, negative impact.
Right. So, I mean, like, you know, and talking even more broadly, there are countries, just entire countries, that have a better record of treatment of employees, of environmental, you know, watchdogs, of dealing with certain products that may or, you know, that may or may not be either hazardous to the health, hazardous to the environment, or something like that. I mean, there are some, like, for example, we always knew or have known that, for as an example, like, there is a lot of pollution and problems in China, right? We know that. So generally, and of course, some of the materials they use, as well as the treatment of employees and all that. So China kind of would not fit the bill, generally speaking, for an investor that would be looking at sustainability or sustainable, you know, these type of investments that are, you know, friendly, if you will. Right. Would that be a fair statement?
It would be. We work with a foundation, for example, that won't invest in the Sudan or other countries with regimes that look like that, for concern of human rights and other issues. So, yeah, whether it be governments or it be corporations, there's a number of ways that you can measure impact and invest money in a way that promotes and has a positive impact in the world, mm-hmm. No doubt about it. Yeah. And that's the promise and the opportunity. And I think one of the drivers that seeing this segment of the market grow faster than any other segment of the investable marketplace today.
Mm, fascinating stuff. Well, James Lundberg, again, co-founder, executive vice president of InvestNet. We'll put some links to your site and some areas that you can find some more information on some of the discussions that he and his group are having. I really appreciate it. Very interesting stuff that you're dealing with here. And I think that an area that probably people know about, but just a tip of, you know, I mean, I think this is something that you're going to hear a lot more about, and it's going to be a lot more awareness, and probably due to the fact that we're pushed into it by the younger generation pushing it that way.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to speak with you, and we should all know that we have opportunities to make the world a better place through our investments and do it in a way that's not necessarily concessionary.
Yep, I hear you. All right, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
All right, bye-bye. Excellent. Excellent conversation. I enjoy when we go a little bit outside the range of what we typically talk about, just about markets and things of that nature, and the Fed, of course, but we get into a discussion that has a lot more depth and hopefully gives you an awareness of another area of investing that may be beneficial. So anyway, I think that was pretty cool. And I'm going to kind of take some further looking at what is, you know, what are some of the areas that may in fact be worthwhile to look at when it comes to corporate governance and the impact of social and societal, as well as the environment are on stocks and how companies do. I'm going to kind of keep my eyes just a little more perked up when I hear about some of those things that are going on and when doing my research. So maybe that would be something that you do as well. Let's talk a little bit about some of the potential things that are involved with the election that may have an impact on markets and what they are and possibly some of the winners and losers, some of the areas that we need to be concerned about and some of the things that we may be able to benefit from in terms of our portfolios and maybe getting a little bit of preparation ahead of this. So here's a couple of things that I thought were interesting. This was I watched a wonderful presentation by the gang over at briefing.com, and I actually have one of the lead analysts coming on an upcoming show. I think, you know, we're pretty booked up for a bit, but I think in about 3 or 4 episodes from now. But anyway, I thought there was a couple of things that I took away from this particular presentation that was really interesting. First of all, some of the differences in each of the candidates' particular tax plans. Now, of course, we don't know what the end of the final plan that they put into place, that, by the way, may or may not be approved by Congress, et cetera, et cetera. But if they did, in fact, get some of the things that they were planning on as far as what is being discussed today, what their plans are today, what they would like to see, how they would like to see things go, and if, in fact, they can persuade Congress to vote on this, et cetera, and change some of the rules. And, well, let's talk a little bit about where we are with that. So under Clinton, there's a significant change in the capital gains tax rate. So according to the current plan, and this is again from briefing, under Clinton's plan, there would be an increase in the federal capital gains taxes with a marginal rate of 47.4%, significantly higher than where we are today. After 2 years of holding an investment, the rate would decrease. The lowest rate of 20%, which is where we are now, pretty much, for long term, the lowest rate of 20% would be only achieved on a six-year holding period, which is currently at 1 year. So this is an increase of a holding period of 6 years to get the 20% rate. And the likely response to this is probably a reduction in liquidity overall, because people would be possibly holding on to things for a bit longer. And whether it becomes 6 years or 5 years or 4 years, it's significantly longer than the 1 year currently. And there's a major impact in terms of taxes on the short-term tax rate. Now, in Trump's plan, which we don't have a lot of details on, because that's seemingly the way that Trump operates, is gives us a little bit of tidbit, but would repeal the 3.8 surcharge for the Affordable Care Act. So this has to do with taxes. Has hinted and expect now that there will be a lower rate on capital gains, so which is a direct contradiction to Clinton's plan. And also, short-term capital gains will be taxed at lower margins. So overall, that talks about lower taxes, which is pretty much a Republican stance on things. Now, here's what the reaction to what we know, again, not much on the Trump side, couple of things on the Clinton side, but probably what the outcome would be if the Democrats win. Now, this is the Democrats win overwhelmingly in terms of the presidential election and maybe pick up some seats in Congress. Would likely increase selling by the end of 2016 to lock in the winners and lock in gains at the current rates. Because if, in fact, they do increase the capital, or if there's a chance for them to increase the capital gains rate into 2017 and beyond, well, a lot of people are going to say, you know what, let me just lock this in and be done with it. Now, if Republicans get in, and if, in fact, there is the thought that there's going to be a reduction in capital gains rate, it would probably delay selling to capture lower tax rates. Now, this is kind of interesting because there's been a lot of discussion about if Donald Trump gets into office, oh my God, the apocalypse, all this horrible stuff. You see all this, you know, wow, the market's going to crash and all this. Now, obviously, there's a lot of other reasons that may affect markets in terms of a Trump presidency. But just think about this, and this does make a lot of sense, actually, in terms of the pressure for selling, if in fact the Democrats do win, and if in fact things are, you know, what we know, what we have now is what we get, so therefore there's not a lot of market volatility going on, so the market volatility won't really be due to the president, quote unquote, because of any kind of radical tariffs and walls they put up and other things that are going on. But the thing is, if they do in fact increase rates, there's going to be a lot of selling that goes on. So I don't think we're out of the woods if Clinton and Democrats maintain a major foothold into the election. I think that makes a lot of sense if you think about that for a second. Now, it may not be dramatic, but there could be a very significant increase in selling pressure. And of course, even though the Republicans get in, if there is any kind of concern over many of the trade deals, et cetera, if Trump gets in and if the Republicans take more of the Congress, then even though there would be a bit of a delay possibly in selling to capture the lower taxes that could be in the future, well, there may be some other upheaval in the interim. Now, under these plans, you have to look at this, that momentum stocks are probably going to be held under the Trump plan or under a Trump presidency or a Republican presidency. Value stocks will be kept under a Clinton plan. So your high growth is more Republican favorable and your value more Clinton. And that has to do with the taxes, dividend yields, growth and gains. Now, here's some other things that are that came up that I thought was kind of interesting. The various sectors, again, briefing.com did a great, this is Gavin McGuire. He did a great job at really identifying and doing explanation of the winners and losers in terms of sectors dependent on a Trump or a Clinton win. Now, there's a few of these here, and I'll just go through these with you. You could write these down, and we could talk about some of these. But we'll start with, it's on the top, Trump winners and losers. So the major winners under a Trump presidency, at least the way the market would envision it at this point, is oil and gas, aerospace and defense, materials, domestic manufacturing, multinationals, coal, and volatility. In other words, there could be a lot of movement in markets and therefore things like buying the VIX or any other kind of protection against volatility would be significant. And I'm going to get back to this in a second on a couple of these sectors that they talked about because I have some disagreement. Minor winners, pharmaceutical, biotechs, medical devices, utilities, financials, and REITs, real estate. Well, that makes sense. Losers, housing stocks, which kind of goes against the whole REIT side, but okay. And municipal bonds, because of course, he's been talking about auditing the Fed. He's been talking about, the various exposure and bonds, and possibly rates will go higher. Major losers, consumer staples, healthcare providers. Now, one of the ones I had a little bit of a contradiction with and a disagreement with is aerospace and defense, for example. So one of the big concerns about a Trump presidency is the tariffs and the cross borders and the potential deals that we have for multinationals. Now, while there's also a benefit from, at least what we know, is there would be a tremendous buildup in the area of defense, defense for the U.S., we get a tremendous amount of our overall GDP from sales of transportation vis-a-vis airlines and transportation. And we sell a lot of those overseas. So the big question is going to be, is there a balance there? So maybe the defense stocks would be more of a thing to look at, like a Lockheed or maybe Boeing, at least, yes. But there may be some drawdown in other transportation areas that we do ship overseas. So just one thing that I had a little bit of a question mark with. Healthcare providers, it would be interesting because it's talking about repeal. This is a major loser. Repeal of Obamacare. What I think is really interesting is how several of the healthcare providers, particularly the insurance companies, HMOs, et cetera, and the participants in the various exchanges have been pulling out due to the fact that they say that there's losses. This is bad. It's no good. Meanwhile, their stocks have done extremely well. The profitability has gone up dramatically. But yet, because of the possible repeal of Obamacare, healthcare providers are going to be hurt under this. I think it could go both ways there. Now, a Clinton presidency, winners and losers. Major winners, alternative energy, solar, wind. Materials, because of all the infrastructure spend, right? So under, even though both talk about a major boom for infrastructure development and bridges and roads and quote unquote shovel ready and all these kind of things, it looks like both sides will really benefit the materials. So that'd be something to take a look at there. You could look at some of the steel manufacturers and maybe maybe even a Caterpillar. You could look at because of the infrastructure build. You could look at any of the steel / copper / any of the concrete, etc. Those are going to be winners. It seems to be across both lines. Healthcare facilities and services under Clinton. Well, that makes sense. Now minor winners. Technical and telecom, consumer staples, aerospace and defense. So. Basically, under both, we have major and minor winners for aerospace and defense. So we have materials on both sides, and we also have aerospace and defense. Losers under Clinton, consumer discretionary, oil and gas, MLPs, student lenders, prison operators, which we know, and big banks. Now, I probably would agree with most of that. Consumer discretionary, I'm not quite sure why that one really is in play there as a minor loser, but let's call that a neutral. Clearly, the desire for Clinton to have a clean energy and greener type of energy suppliers is extremely important. And of course, Donald Trump has talked about coal. Coal being a, you know, we're gonna get back to clean burning coal, et cetera, and not really pushing on the green energy as much. But that would obviously be, you know, significant in terms of Clinton and Clinton winning for alternative energy. And yes, and a negative for Clinton in terms of that. Major losers in a Clinton presidency would be coal, which we know that's kind of that seems to be a crapshoot dependent on who wins there. Coal is clearly, I think, and identifiably one of the sectors that could have a problem. Pharmaceuticals, we know that. We know that the Democrats have, as a matter of fact, last week, Bernie Sanders put out a tweet and dropped a stock 15%, like just by mentioning their name. But pharmaceuticals, they have their eye on. The target is set. And the Democrats are clearly after the pharmaceutical companies. I don't think we have any question about that. And this is one that I'm trying to really think about here. And I'm having a difficult time understanding the major losers in a Clinton presidency. So it's coal, pharma, and restaurants. Restaurants. I don't get it. Maybe I'll ask Gavin what he's talking about there. I mean, if we could speculate why restaurants would be a major loser, is it because possibly that we would have no growth in wages and, you know, we'd have more of the same that we have today and therefore what's happening is more people eating at home? Or is it because, I don't know. I just can't, I'm having a hard time with this one. With the restaurants. Maybe you can let me, I don't know, maybe you could tell me what you think is the reason why restaurants, I mean, is it because people will be eating home more? Because, it's not coming to me here. But anyway, so that's something to think about. I thought it was a really good piece by Gavin overall. Again, I'll ask him what's going on. Maybe you could send me your comments. I'd be happy to listen to why restaurants would be a major loser, like coal or like pharmaceuticals under a Clinton presidency. I just wanted to close on something that I saw last week. I thought was really kind of, distasteful. So about a week ago or so, Honeywell came out with they were in an investor day, and they had a discussion about their current earnings outlook and, you know, their guidance and kind of trying to really give a discussion about what they saw in the global environment in terms of what's going to be affecting their company in the future. And it was really kind of, it was miserable. I mean, really, they gave a relatively downbeat outlook. Stock dropped about 10%. This on the heels of Alcoa coming in and a little bit shy and several other industrials coming in and really not giving a very good outlook. So it kind of cemented in the idea that things are not so great when it comes to the industrials, at least at this point of time in the economic cycle, with the global backdrop and economic backdrop as it is. Now, fast forward about a week, and magically, the CEO of Honeywell appears on Mad Money on CNBC at night and starts talking about how, well, you know, I think that I was a little bit too pessimistic, and I just want to let you know that I don't think I really conveyed what I wanted to. I think I made a mistake. I blew it. And he's coming on with all sorts of apologies and things about how, well, it maybe isn't that bad, and how I really presented it, and how it came across, and blah, 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 and you know, really the stock, I think, really right now is undervalued, which, by the way, he's going to be stepping down in not too near future, in the near future, I should say. And maybe really he was just, oh man, did I blow it? I'm about to kind of take an exit here. And I talked down the stock moved down 10%. And here I am, what a schmuck. I'm going to go back and just pump this thing right back up if I can, because, you know, things aren't maybe as bad, or gosh, the stock really overreacted. I got to do something. Now, you take the reverse of this, it would never happen. If the company was talking up things and saying, hey, these things are really good, and the stock was up 5%, do you think you'd come back and say, you know, I blew it. I got to tell you, stock's overvalued here. stock, you misunderstood what I was saying, and it's not as good as what I was saying. It's not, I got to be honest with you, it's really got to really think about what I was talking about, and it was kind of much more on the negative than it should have been. No. So I find it, this whole thing about allowing these CEOs to kind of talk and then talk up their stock, talk their book, and Jim Cramer just kind of lets them be, of course, because they're a big, industrial. He probably has it in this quote-unquote charitable trust. I don't know. I just think the whole thing. And then you get into the whole, let's kind of pick on CNBC while we're at it. The whole Twitter thing, CRM, Salesforce dropped the bid, at least officially said they're not interested on Friday, dropped the stock about 7%. This is after Microsoft and Google and several other parties said, we're not interested either, at least at these prices. I think we talked about last week how there's a discussion, at least I saw it this week, there was a discussion that until the price gets to about 14, there's not going to be much interest from some of the players out there. The price is too rich at this point. But throughout the week, last week, and when the stock went up 20%, when supposedly Google was interested, David Faber at CNBC was all over this. Every single time anybody was pushing a little bit of information to him about a potential bidder for Twitter, he would report it and be like, here's another one. And it was almost like, why are you pushing this so much? So here's a little lesson that we've talked about so many times, a theme that we've kind of hit upon many, many, many times, is just be very careful of the headlines. We know that there is a potential sale coming up for Twitter. Who knows what the price is going to be? We don't know if it's going to be maybe going private. We don't know if maybe one of these other players are going to come back at a lower price or a higher price. We don't know if maybe a Chinese firm is going to come out of the blue and buy them up, like a Sina or a Weibo or NetEase. We don't know. But the bottom line is that this is going to be, I think, something that's going to be in the news for a while. Watch for it. Especially when David Faber gets all over this. It's like somebody's feeding him all this news and he wants to be the first in there to report it, even though a lot of it was bogus. A lot of the information about this whole potential sale last week was totally bogus. Bogus. So just again about watching the news, understanding where the information comes from, the flow, and from there making a decision that's, possibly smart. Listen, it could have gone either way with Twitter, with or without the Faber news. There could have been somebody picking it up. There was a lot of pressure not to. I still think Twitter, generally speaking, is a great platform. It's a good property. They just have to get a new management team in there and somebody to spruce it up and possibly even somebody to take it over to, add on and bolt on their advertising, exposure, and then things will be fine. I really do think that there is an opportunity for it. So anyway, as I mentioned, ask any questions, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This week we are on with John C. Dvorak, myself on DH Unplugged Tuesday evening, late. That will be released. And what else do I have to say? I don't know, but you can visit all the information. We're going to have the third quarter economic commentary up on the Disciplined Investor soon. Make sure to follow me on Twitter. I'll announce it there. Andrew Horowitz is one word, is the Twitter handle where you can follow me, and I'll make an announcement of how to get that third quarter economic commentary that we write for our clients and for you. Make sure to do that, and you can get your hands on it shortly. Anyway, thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Have a good one. Have a profitable one. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.